All right, welcome in everyone to the deep dive. So today we're going to be looking at a case, a South Carolina Supreme Court case. The case is Grissett v. Seng. It's from 2006, and on the face of it, it might not sound like the most thrilling topic, right? Utility easements,
Right.
but I think you're going to find this one's pretty interesting because it really gets at how the law tries to deal with these changes in technology and how that bumps up against sort of traditional property rights. So it's really this clash between old school property law and this really modern piece of technology, fiber optic lines, and the result is kind of fascinating.
Yeah, I think that's a great way to put it. I mean, the case really forces us to grapple with this question of, how far do property rights extend when you have these rapid advancements in technology? So we've got landowners who, years ago granted these easements for what at the time was pretty standard utility infrastructure, things like power lines. And then, fast forward a bit, and now you've got the utility company using those easements in a way that seems, pretty different. They're leasing out space for these high-speed communication lines to other companies, right?
Yeah.
And so it really raises this fundamental tension, like how do we balance this need to promote progress, technological progress, while also making sure that we're respecting the rights of those property owners. It's a tough question.
Yeah, absolutely. So maybe we can just start with like the very basic like conflict here, right? Like what's at the heart of this disagreement?
Okay, so to understand the conflict, you got to go back to these original easements that were granted to the utility company, which is South Carolina Electric and Gas, or SEEG. So these easements, they allowed SEEG to build and maintain these electric transmission lines, right? Pretty standard stuff. But here's the key. The easements also included this language about, allowing telegraph or telephone lines that were necessary or convenient for SEEG to carry out their utility operations, right? Like, to run the power grid.
Yeah.
So, we move forward in time to the 1990s, and SEEG, they start installing these fiber optic lines along those existing easements. And, the landowners, they weren't really objecting to SEEG using that fiber, for their own communications,
Yeah.
right? Like things they need to do to operate the power grid. But the real problem, the thing that sparked this whole case, was that SEEG started leasing out that extra capacity on those fiber optic lines to other telecom companies. So essentially, they were kind of becoming a landlord in this internet and data business, right? And you were doing it on this private land.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that the landowners are basically saying, hey, we gave you permission for utility-related communication, right? Not to like run a for-profit internet service on our property. Is that kind of the gist of it?
Yeah, that's exactly it. They felt like this whole leasing thing, this was going way beyond, what they had originally agreed to in those easements, right? Like it just wasn't part of the deal. They argued it was a real overreach of the rights that SEEG had been granted. And so what did they do? They sued. They filed a lawsuit against SEEG. They alleged all sorts of things like trespass, unjust enrichment, and they really wanted the court to step in and say, "Hey, stop this leasing. You can't do that." They wanted an injunction to stop it.
Okay, so the landowners, they file suit. What happened next?
So things took a little bit of an unexpected turn, at least for the landowners. So the trial court actually dismissed the case pretty early on. And they did this by granting SEEG's motion to dismiss. And this is a pretty important procedural thing here. They granted this under what's called Rule 12b-6 of the South Carolina Rules of Civil Procedure. Now, I know that might sound a little jargony, but basically what that rule says is that, a court can dismiss a case if even if everything the plaintiff, in this case landowners, are saying is true, there's just no way under the law that they can win.
Right.
It's like the court is saying, you don't even have a valid legal claim here.
Okay. So what was the trial court's thinking? Like why did they think that the landowners didn't even have a legal claim?
Yeah, so the trial court really leaned on past cases, on precedent, right?
Yeah.
On what courts in South Carolina had said in similar cases before. And specifically, they looked at cases like Lay and Leppard. And these cases, they had often been interpreted as giving utility companies, a fair amount of flexibility in how they use their easements, right? Even as technology changed, like for instance, moving from those old copper wires to the newer fiber optics for communication. So the trial court seemed to think that these earlier cases basically meant that utilities had this inherent right to use their existing infrastructure for these kinds of related services, right? Things that were kind of connected to their core business. And it's interesting, right? Because this really shows you how important precedent is in the legal system. But it also shows you how precedent can sometimes run into problems when you're dealing with these really, really new situations, right? These really new factual scenarios.
So that's the trial court. But obviously it didn't end there, right? The landowners didn't just say, okay, we give up. They appealed that decision, right?
Yeah, they did. And this is where things get really interesting, I think. The South Carolina Supreme Court, they take a look at what the trial court did.
Yeah.
And they actually reverse the decision, right? They overturn it. And they send the case back down to the trial court for more proceedings.
Okay, so the Supreme Court is basically saying, hold on a second here, you might have been a little too quick to dismiss this case. So I guess my question is, what was the Supreme Court's reasoning there? Why did they reverse the trial court's decision?
Yeah, it's a good question. And the Supreme Court really focused in on this really fundamental part of civil procedure, right? Like how these cases are supposed to work. So, you know, when a court is looking at a motion to dismiss under that rule we talked about, that the rule 12B, they have to accept all of the plaintiff's allegations as being true, right? They can't just say, oh, we don't believe you. Mm. So here, the landowners had alleged that SCE&G, by leasing out to these third parties, was going beyond what the original easement allowed them to do. And the Supreme Court said, look, at this stage, it's just too early to throw out the case. The landowners had made a plausible legal argument, right? Like it was an argument that made sense, that could potentially be a winning argument, and it needed to be looked at more carefully. And to do that, you know, they needed the chance to present their evidence, to build up the factual record, right? Mm-hmm. To really, mm-hmm. really dig into the details of the case.
Okay, so I want to make sure I understand this correctly. So the Supreme Court wasn't necessarily saying that the landowners were definitely going to win the case, right? It's more like they were saying, hey, they deserve their day in court. They deserve to have their arguments actually heard and considered.
Yeah, exactly. It's more about the process, right? It's a procedural ruling about whether the case should have been, you know, just shut down right away. But to get to that decision, to get to that procedural ruling, the Supreme Court had to start looking at the actual legal issues at the heart of this whole dispute, right? They had to start thinking about, like, okay, mm-hmm. well, What are the real legal questions that need to be answered here?
Right, right. So I guess the next logical question then is, well, what were those key legal questions that the Supreme Court identified? What were the things that needed to be figured out?
Yeah, so they really boiled down to two big questions. Mm-hmm. The first was, did SCE&G violate the original easement by leasing out that extra fiber optic capacity?
Right.
Like, did that violate that necessary or convenient language that was in the easements? And then the second question, which is really about the process, was it right for the trial court to dismiss the case in the first place?
Yeah.
Like, was it right to use that rule 12b6? So it's really a question about the substance of the case, right?
Mm.
Like what the law actually says, and a question about how the case was handled, right? It's about the procedure.
Okay, so let's tackle that first question then. Let's talk about the language in the easement. How did the Supreme Court interpret that phrase, necessary or convenient? What did they think that meant?
Yeah, so here's where the court really emphasized this really important principle of property law. And the principle is this: the rights that you get from an easement, they're strictly limited by the actual words that were used when that easement was created,
right? Yeah.
It's not like you can just assume an easement gives you, you know, this unlimited power to do whatever you want on someone else's property. So the court, they really focused on that phrase, necessary or convenient, and they interpreted it, you know, specifically in the context of SCE&G's own operations, right? Their own electric utility operations. They basically said, look, this language, it limits SCE&G to those activities that really directly support their primary business, which is providing electricity. And I think this really highlights something crucial about how we interpret legal language, right? Sometimes you'll see these words that seem really broad, right? Really open-ended. But you have to read them in light of the specific purpose of the agreement, right? What were the parties actually trying to accomplish here?
Okay, so I think what you're saying is, you know, that phrase necessary or convenient, it wasn't meant to be this like blank check for SCE&G to do any kind of business activity that they thought they could make money from.
No, exactly. It wasn't a green light for any profitable scheme they could dream up. The court's reasoning It suggests that, just because fiber optics might be seen as convenient for some aspect of their business, right? Their overall business, that doesn't mean they could just lease out that extra capacity for something totally different.
Right.
Some separate commercial venture that wasn't really connected to their main function as an electric utility. And I think this quote from the court really sums it up. They said, and I'm quoting here, "The rights of an easement holder depend upon the interpretation of the grant in the easement." Right. So what they're saying is you got to look at the specific words of the easement. Right. That's what really matters.
OK, so we've got this interpretation of necessary or convenient. But the trial court, they relied on those earlier cases. Right. Land Leopard. So how did the Supreme Court deal with those precedents? How did they say that this case was different?
Right. Right. That's a really important point. And the Supreme Court, they said, look, those earlier cases, they mostly dealt with this idea of additional servitude. And what that means is that, the easement holder is trying to put something totally new on the property, right? Something that wasn't part of the original deal, something that wasn't contemplated when that easement was granted. So think about it like this. Let's say you have an easement that lets someone run water lines across your property. And then all of a sudden, they want to build a, big shed right there. That shed, that's an additional servitude, right? Is this new burden on your property.
Okay, got it. That makes sense. So how did the Supreme Court say that Grissett was different from that?
Yeah, so their argument was that, Grissett wasn't really about SCEG adding a completely new physical structure to the land, right? Like the fiber optic lines, they were installed on those existing utility poles, which were allowed under the original easement. So it wasn't about like physically adding something new. Instead, the core issue was about apportionment, right? And what that means is, did SCEG have the right to essentially share or lease out part of the use that they were allowed, right? To let these other companies use the existing infrastructure for their own commercial gain. And the court made this really important distinction. They said, and I'm quoting here, "The issue of apportionment is a slightly different issue from that of additional servitude." Right. So they're saying that these are two separate things. And they went on to say that those earlier cases, they didn't really address this question of apportionment. They didn't involve any limits on how an easement holder could share their allowed use. And I think this really shows how a precedent, even though it's important, it has its limits. It can't always answer every question, especially when you have these really, really new situations.
Yeah, I see what you mean. So it's not about, whether SCEG built something new on the property. It's about who's actually using the existing infrastructure, right? And what they're using it for. Are they using it for the utility's own operations, or are they using it to make money for these other companies?
Yeah, exactly. You got it.
Okay, so I think that distinction between additional servitude and apportionment can be a little tricky. Is there maybe a real world analogy that could help sort of clarify that difference?
Yeah, definitely. Well, let me try this. Imagine you let your neighbor use your driveway to get to their house, right?
Sure.
So that's the original agreement, the original use.
Yeah.
Now, an additional servitude would be if your neighbor decided, "Hey, I'm going to build a car repair shop on your driveway."
Right.
Right. Now there's this whole new structure on your property, right? It's a big new burden.
Yeah.
But apportionment, that would be like your neighbor saying, "Okay, I'm gonna rent out some parking spots on your driveway to people who work in the office building down the street."
Right. So they're not building anything new, but they're letting other people use your property, right? Okay. They're using that easement to make money from these third parties. And that wasn't part of the original deal.
Okay, yeah, that actually really helps. It makes that distinction much clearer. So the Supreme Court, they're basically saying that SCEG's leasing is more like this apportionment issue,
yeah.
Right? And that's something that those earlier cases didn't really deal with.
Exactly. Exactly. You got it. And this actually leads us to another really important part of the Supreme Court's reasoning, which is this question of ambiguity, right? Like, was the language in the original easement clear, or was it a little bit vague, a little bit open to interpretation?
So I guess the question is, what specific part of the easement's wording did the Supreme Court find ambiguous? Like, where was the vagueness?
Yeah, so the court really honed in on this one phrase. The easement said that the use of the land had to be for communications necessary to SCEG's business. And they said, look, this language, it creates some uncertainty.
Yeah.
It's not totally clear whether leasing those fiber optic lines to other companies was actually necessary for SCEG to do their job, right, to run the power grid? Was it really supporting their core operations, or was it just this separate way to make money? And the court felt like this ambiguity, this uncertainty, it was a really big deal. It meant that the case needed to go forward, right? That you couldn't just dismiss it at the outset. They needed to look at more evidence to really figure out what those words meant in this specific context. And this quote from the court really gets at that. They said, and again, I'm quoting here, "The language limiting the use of the easement to communications necessary to SCE&G's business appears to restrict that assignability. This ambiguity requires construction of the written easements themselves." Right. So they're saying we can't just assume what this means. We need to really dig into the easements to figure out what the parties intended.
OK, so because the language wasn't perfectly crystal clear, the case shouldn't have been dismissed. Right. It needed more examination.
Exactly. Exactly. The court said, you know, we got to figure out what this phrase really means. And you can't do that just by looking at the complaint. Right. You need to hear from both sides. You need to look at the evidence.
OK, so that brings us back to the procedural side of things. Right. Back to that Rule 12b-6. So the Supreme Court reversed the trial court's dismissal. And I guess my question is, what was their final word on why that was the wrong move? Why was it wrong to dismiss the case?
Yeah. So they basically said, look, dismissing a case under this rule, it's a big deal, right? It's a drastic remedy. You know, it's only appropriate if it's just absolutely clear that the plaintiff, in this case, the landowners, has no legal basis for their claim, right? Like, no matter what the facts are, there's just no way they can win. But here, the landowners, they had made this specific allegation, right? They said that SCE&G was exceeding the scope of the easement by leasing to those third parties. And the Supreme Court said, look, that's a plausible legal argument. Like, it's an argument that could potentially win. And that means that it needs to be, you know, it needs to be heard. It needs to be examined. You can't just dismiss it out of hand. The plaintiffs, they had done enough to get their foot in the door, so to speak. They had presented enough of a legal argument to move the case forward.
Okay, so I guess the big question for our listeners, especially if they're, you know, law students who are trying to understand this stuff, is, you know, what are the key takeaways from this Grissette case? What should they really remember about it?
Yeah, great question. I think, you know, there are a few really big lessons here. The first one, and I think this is the most important one, is that, you know, when you're dealing with easements, the specific words, mm-hmm. the specific language of that easement, that's everything.
Right.
An easement is not just this vague permission slip that lets you do whatever you want on someone's land. The exact scope of the easement, the things you're allowed to do, the things you're not allowed to do, it's all defined by what that easement actually says, mm-hmm. right? By the words on the page. And it definitely doesn't give the easement holder unlimited rights to just do whatever they want.
So an easement's not a blank check.
Exactly. It's not a blank check.
Okay. And what about on the civil procedure side? What's the big takeaway there?
So on the procedure side, I think Grissette really highlights the standard that courts have to use when they're looking at these motions to dismiss under Rule 12b-6. At that early stage, you know, the court isn't supposed to be deciding who's right or wrong, mm-hmm. right? They're not making those kinds of factual findings. What they're supposed to do is assume that everything the plaintiff says is true. And then they ask, okay, if all of that is true, could the plaintiff potentially win this case? Is there a legal theory that could allow them to recover? And if the answer is yes, if there's even possibility, then the case has to move forward. And I think this case really shows that dismissal at that stage. It's a high bar to clear, right? It's only appropriate in those really limited situations where there's just no plausible legal argument at all.
Okay. That makes sense. Now, you know, zooming out a bit, looking beyond just the specific legal doctrines here, do you think there's like a bigger point to this case, especially, you know, in our world today where technology is changing so rapidly?
Well, absolutely. I mean, Grissette, I think it's this great example of how fast moving technology can really, really challenge the law, right? Mm-hmm. Especially in areas like property law, where, you know, things tend to move a little bit slower. So, you know, we've got these new technologies popping up all the time, and they're creating all these new business opportunities, right? But sometimes those opportunities, they clash with existing agreements,
yeah.
with existing understandings about how we use land. And Grissette, it really highlights that tension, right? It forces us to think about how we balance, you know, encouraging all this new technology with protecting the rights of property owners who might have made these agreements, you know, decades ago when none of this stuff even existed.
Right. So like the language in that easement, you know, it was probably written, you know, who knows how long ago, right?
Yeah.
Way before anyone even thought about fiber optics. And now all of a sudden that language has to be interpreted in light of this whole new world of technology and all these new ways of doing business. It's pretty amazing, actually.
It is. And it shows that, you know, even areas of the law that we think are settled, they can be revisited, right? They can be reinterpreted when you have these really new, really novel situations.
Well, this has been a really, really interesting look at Grissette v. SCENG. You know, it just goes to show that even these seemingly kind of dry technical legal cases can have some really big implications, right? Especially when you're talking about, you know, things like technology and basic property rights.
I agree 100%. It's a great reminder that the details of the law, you know, the words in the agreements, the procedural rules, they really do matter. They have real world consequences.
Couldn't agree more. And on that note, I think we'll leave our listeners with a little something to think about, right?
Okay.
A final thought to chew on. So Thinking about this Grissette case, how should we be drafting these legal agreements, you know, these easements and things like that, to make sure they can handle all these unforeseen technological changes?
Right.
Like, what about drone delivery? What about, you know, who even knows what kind of communications networks we'll have in the future, right? How do we build that flexibility into our agreements? How do we make sure that we're protecting people's property rights while also leaving room for innovation, right? I think Grissette really shows us how important it is to be thoughtful, to be precise with our language, right? Especially when we're dealing with things that could have implications for years and years to come. So that's something to think about, right? How do we strike that balance between progress and protection? Really, really interesting stuff. And with that, we'll wrap up our deep dive for today. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate it.